All right, I'm glad. Okay, so then without further ado, let's get started. What we went through over the course of the last two classes is we explored not the place of Tanakh per se in Jewish thought, but rather we set about we've already demonstrated over the course of these lectures the primary importance of Tanakh as a shared heritage of all Jews, even if these Jews didn't necessarily share a bunch of other commitments. What sort of held the glue that sort of held them together was the shared heritage of most of the books of Tanakh, give or take a couple, but Chumash certainly stood at the pinnacle of this hierarchy of books. And the question that we asked was, I think, more fundamental, which is not which books were important, but how do we know what those books said? So we explored the archaeological evidence, the textual evidence for preservation of the words of Tanakh.
Which books?
Of Chumash and the other books of Tanakh. How do we know what they said? We concluded that we have evidence both of great variation in some cases of the text of Tanakh. In other words, there are certain times where we certainly can't be sure what it was that the Torah says, and it's possible that the version that we have may have been different from the version that existed once upon a time. But we also found great evidence for a dedication to the preservation of Tanakh, to the preservation of the text of Tanakh, and we saw that there is good reason to suspect that even to the extent that errors in transmission are almost inevitably bound to creep in, there is a concerted effort to keep them out, and this effort is in many respects successful. Then, what we looked at last time were instances both in terms of texts that eventually make up the Gospels of the New Testament, and we looked as well at texts from Chumash. We looked at cases where people mistakenly introduce errors into important or sacred texts, but we saw cases in which people deliberately introduce changes into important and sacred texts. Whether that be the text of the Gospel of Luke, in the famous story of Jesus sweating blood, which we saw as the late addition to the text, or in cases of Chumash, whether it be the Samaritans changing Hamakom Asher Yivchar, which would refer to Jerusalem, to Makom Asher Bachar, which would refer to Shechem, or in the case of in the case of Tikkuni Sofrim, in the cases where Chazal point to certain changes that were introduced either into the words of Tanakh or into the order of events as they are described in Tanakh, that were introduced for the purposes of preserving the dignity of God. So essentially where we are right now is we've sort of established a baseline for how people treat the things that they have in common. So what I'd like to do in this class is pivot and ask ourselves, how do people start to mark out not common spaces, but differences? So one question that I think it's important to discuss is the question of, is there such a category as unacceptable difference in the context of early Judaism and Christianity, and then in particular, of course, because this is the group that interests us the most, and whose words we care about the most, is there such a category for Chazal? So the general term that's used to cover the broad spectrum of unacceptable difference as it appears in Judaism and Christianity is the word heresy. Heresy is usually the word that we use to describe the way in which a given person will categorize those whose thought is out of bounds with respect to one's own. So if I believe that vanilla ice cream is the only acceptable form of ice cream, so I might go around and try to identify all of those chocolateites, all of those people who think, Rahman al-Itzlan, that chocolate is better than vanilla. So those would be my heretics, it's possible. Or I could live in a pluralistic society where, listen, I like vanilla, but there are those who like chocolate, and that's okay. So we can all live together. So is there such a category among Jews, among early followers of Jesus, among people that we might eventually come to call Christians, of heresy? Is there such a thing as heresy? And if there is, what is it? How do we define it? What does it mean for early Judaism, for early Christianity, and what does it mean for us? So the first question that I'd like to do is, well, I think we need to do two things. Number one, we need to point to some to a possible misconception, and then mark it out clearly so that we can examine it properly. And number two, I think we need to, and we'll do this at the same time, concurrently, we need to propound some rigorous definitions of terms that we're going to use. So, what is the Hebrew term for, yes?
Will you also give us examples like the Vilna Gaon that thought that Hasidut was a heresy?
Right, so we're not going to go...
My point is, but it evolved to a time where it became... Are you also going to give us examples of things that were once considered heretical and then got absorbed into the mainstream?
Yeah, we're going to do that. We're going to do that in much more detail next time when we talk about one particular instantiation of what we're talking about, which is the Birkas Aminim, when we talk about the bracha that we have in Shemona Esrei, in our Shemona Esrei, that is ostensibly directed at the kind of thing that we're talking about. But again, before we get to that question, which I think is requires some sort of specificity, we need to define our terms. So first of all, is there a rabbinic term for heretic, for heresy? Right. So Chazal, to the best of my knowledge, in other words, maybe Erev Rav, right? And the thought of Chazal, so the Erev Rav is sort of the mixed multitude, the people who are outside of, right? But the Erev Rav are sort of, the point of the Erev Rav is that, at least the way that that biblical term is interpreted by Chazal, these are people who are sort of a fifth column, but at least in principle, they're welcomed into the Jewish people.
They're like the rabbis.
Apikoros.
An apikoros.
Is a Greek word, but it was...
Right. So is a person who sees a person who, well, we're not exactly sure what an apikoros is, right, which is sort of the... Right.
I thought it really came from Epicurean to me.
Right, so Epicoros is the sort of rabbinic, the Hebraicized form of Epicurean. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, well, do we know what Napikoros believes, and is such a person allowed into the community, or is such a person have to remain outside the community? In other words, we know, let's say a person is, we're told about a person, like an apikoros, that ein lo chelik b'olam haba, that a person doesn't have a share in the world to come. So does that mean that that person can't daven in our shuls? Does that mean that that person can't live in our communities? I mean, it's an important question. It might be the answer is yes, it might be the answer is no, it might be the answer is, well, we'd like that person to leave, but we can't force them, so the worst thing we can do is tell them they have no chelik in olam haba. So these are all live questions. We have to examine the evidence. So one thing that I want...
Elisha ben Avuya.
So, right, so here's the question that I want to ask, getting to Elisha ben Avuya. Is there a word... In other words, Elisha ben Avuya, to the best of my knowledge, is never called an apikoros, presumably because he doesn't believe the things, or he may not believe the things, or those aren't as important to his thought. He doesn't believe the things that a person is required to believe in order to be classified as an apikoros. What's the word, and I believe that I'm correct about this, what's the word that we normally would reserve for someone like Elisha ben Avuya? The answer is a min. A min is usually the word that is almost always translated in rabbinic literature as heretic. If a person is guilty of minus, so that would normally be translated into English as heresy. So that and in fact, the bracha that we say in our Shemona Esrei that sort of evolved over time to become directed at all sorts of people. In the iteration that we have, it's directed at informers, sort of Jewish traders. So we go through. I think we go through the whole bracha at this point without mentioning minim. But that bracha is officially called Birkas Haminim. It is the blessing that is recited that calls for the eradication or the punishment or the eventual comeuppance of minim, which normally is translated as heretics. So what we're going to need to do is we're going to have to ask ourselves, does the word minus, which appears in rabbinic literature, and the word min, do those things map on perfectly to heresy and heretic? So first what we have to do is do some definition of terms. What is a heretic and what is heresy? We can only answer those questions by examining the way that these words are used. So if we had more time, we'd look at how these words are used throughout Greek literature, because these ultimately stem from Greek words. The verb is hyreo, which literally means to capture or to apprehend. And the Greek noun that we're concerned with here is hieresis, which would literally, we would translate as heresy. So what is a heresy? What is a hieresis? So let's look at the way that those words are used in early Jewish, in early Christian, which may be one and the same thing at this point, early Jewish literature. And we're going to have to ask ourselves, what exactly is a heretic? What exactly is heresy? So take a look at the sources in source number one. The first source in source number one is from Josephus. Josephus tells us, and this is from his autobiography, early stages of his autobiography, he tells us, "And when I was about 16 years old, I had a mind to comprehend the several hieresaon," right, so the several hieresies, the several heresies, "that were among us. And these," the word here that's translated as sects, I should have deleted this and replaced it with hieresis. So ignore, anytime you see the word sect, just say the word hieresis in your head. These hieresis are three. The first is that of the Pharisees, the second the Sadducees, and the third that of the Essenes, as we have frequently told you. For I thought that by this means I might choose the best if I were once acquainted with them all. So, when I had accomplished my desires, I returned back to the city, being now 19 years old, and began to conduct myself according to the rules of the hieresis of the Pharisees, which is like that of the Stoics, as the Greeks call them." So, I hate the translation of the word hieresis here. Let's ignore it for a second and figure out what this word means. So reading this passage, how is Josephus using the word heresy here? Hieresis. What is a hieresis?
It's used to me. He's using it as the word sect.
As the word sect. So,
if not sect, so the meaning that we put onto sect by different theories of the same thing.
So let's,
sect is the other guy. So,
this is an important point. In other words, I think if we're using the word sect, so what we usually mean by sect is other people, right? But here, I don't think that he's necessarily using that word.
Divisions.
Ah, so that's a little bit more of a value-neutral term, let's say, than sect. So let's see if the word divisions works. So he's just referring to maybe denominations. Is he referring to denominations?
That's a modern term.
Ah, right. So maybe he's referring to denominations. But denomination, I think, carries more the sense of... I'm trying to think. I mean, for me, denomination denotes more. Well, actually, you know, we don't have to go through all this. He gives us a comparison at the end. Josephus gives us a comparison, right? What
I think he's using it as groups without a value in that word at all.
So groups, but to whom does Josephus says at the end of the day that he joins the hieresis? Yeah. Right? Now, the reason I don't like denomination is because, again, denomination usually means a brand of religion with a sort of value judgment or value attached to it. Josephus comes into this discussion neutral about these things. He says, I decided I wanted to choose
one of the... Why do you think denomination has a value?
Well, in other words, if you're joining a denomination, so presumably these are the form... In other words, denomination, I think, I could be wrong about this, when I hear denomination...
It's a Protestant term, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it divides up religion into acceptable categories. If you want to be a Protestant, you have to be one denomination of... If you want to be a Jew, you have to be a denomination of a Jew. You can't just be a Jew. You have to fit into one of the denominations.
Being non-affiliated.
Ah, so now... So when you talk... But when you say... So again, I don't want to get too into the semantics, but when you say non-affiliated, what you're saying is that to be a normal Jew, you have to be affiliated with something. If you're non-affiliated, you're sort of a deficient Jew, right? Because you're not affiliating with one of the acceptable forms of Judaism. So here, I don't think he's using it that way. And by the way, Josephus knows of lots of people, lots of movements or denominations that he doesn't call a hieresis. Jesus, for example. Josephus mentions Jesus. He mentions other sort of eschatological, apocalyptic prophets. He mentions another hieresis, by the way, later, which he calls the fourth hieresis, which he doesn't mention here, and those are the Zealots, who he says are exactly like the Pharisees, except they hate the Romans, right? So there, it doesn't seem to mean denomination, because denomination to me sort of implies a group of religious values, whereas the Zealots are exactly like the Pharisees, have the same religious values, or whatever that might mean. They just hate the Romans. They have different political opinions. Right, so Hieresus here, to whom does he compare the Hieresus that he eventually joins?
The Stoics, which is
the Stoics. Excellent. The Stoics are a philosophical school. And in fact, throughout his writings, whenever he mentions these three groups, which are always together for him, the Pharisees, Sadducees, and the Essenes, Josephus always compares them to Greek philosophical schools, like the Stoics, or the Epicureans, and so on and so forth. So Josephus is key, and remember, Josephus' audience, this is a huge question, who is Josephus' audience, but his audience certainly is composed, in part, of Romans, and people who are used to reading Greek literature. So people to whom he needs to explain what Judaism is actually like, he's giving them categories they can understand. Just like you know about the Stoics and the Epicureans and so on and so forth, there are also those things in Judaism. There are Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes. These are the three major schools. Just because you didn't belong to one didn't mean you're not a Jew, just because you weren't a Stoic didn't mean you weren't a Roman or a Greek. But if you want to sort of get into the elite levels of Judaism, so you would join one of these hieresies, right? Okay. So this, I think, is how Josephus is using these terms. And again, he seems to be reserving these terms for particularly important groups. He doesn't call every single person who believes something wacky a hieresis. He uses these for like the major schools of Judaism. That's how Josephus is using the word hieresis. So here, again, the reason I'm bringing this up is because I think Josephus is trying to be careful, not be careful. It doesn't occur to Josephus to use the word hieresis negatively. He doesn't think it's bad to be a hieresis, to be a heresy. He joins a heresy. Right? So heresy here just means a school of thought. Okay. And take a look in the book of Acts. The book of Acts records the following. So the book of Acts records, and this is one of the major narrative arcs of Acts, is a dispute among the followers of Jesus between those who believe that all followers of Jesus, including Gentiles, should follow the law of Moses, and those who believe that Gentiles need necessarily follow the law of Moses. Okay. So here, the book of Acts tells us, I didn't give you the reference, but it's chapter 15. Josephus tells us, then some of the believers who belonged to the hieresis of the Pharisees stood up and said, the Gentiles must be circumcised and required to keep the law of Moses. So what does this mean? What does hieresis mean in this case? And by the way,
It's those who continue to believe that they were Jews. The Christians who believed they were Jewish.
Right. So, or as we would call them, Jews. Right? These are just Jews. Right? Just like the other Christians were Jews who believed a particular type of thing. These were Jews who believed that if you were a follower of Jesus, so Jesus said that you have to keep the law. Why should we... lo sasso, yaminu small, right? You have to keep the law. So notice that again, this I think throws even more, presents the translation of hieresis as sort of a heresy or even a denomination or maybe a sect as even more problematic. Because again, these are people who are following what the book of Acts considers to be a coherent worldview in and of itself. In other words, these are all followers of Jesus, and that seems to be sufficient as spiritual identification for the author of the book of Acts. So, presumably, just because you belong to the hereses of the Pharisees doesn't mean that you can't belong to another group that's coherent and self-contained. So you could be a Pharisee and you could be a follower of Jesus. Those two things are not incompatible. So again, the word heresy here seems to be used to describe more an official school of thought to which you could subscribe. So just like you can be a Republican member of Cheese of the Month Club, and you can also be a Democrat member of Cheese of the Month Club, so too you can be a Pharisee member of the Jesus Club, and you can be a Sadducee member of the Jesus Club. These two things are not incompatible. Hieresis here seems to just mean group, or school of thought. Okay, so we're going to, just in the interest of time, we're going to skip the next reference from Acts and go down to source number two. Source number two, so already here, by the second century, only a few decades after the book of Acts is composed, we already begin to see the roots of the usage of the word heresy with which we would be familiar. This is from Irenaeus. And Irenaeus, you'll recall from our last class, is a bishop of the city of Lyon in Gaul. And he is a heresy hunter. He's like a Ghostbuster, but for heretics. So he believes that in order to properly ground Christianity as a legitimate movement, and in order to allow Christianity to flourish, it was important to define what was Christianity and what wasn't. And so he exhaustively catalogs all of the different forms of Christianity that he felt were aberrant and were inadmissible. And so here's what he writes. He says, "I do this in order that you, obtaining an acquaintance with these things, may in turn explain them to all those with whom you're concerned and exhort them to avoid such an abyss of madness and of blasphemy against Christ. I intend then, to the best of my ability, with brevity and clearness, to set forth the opinions of those who are now promulgating heresy. I refer especially to the disciples of Ptolemaeus, whose school may be described as a bud from that of Valentinus. I shall also endeavor, according to my moderate ability, to furnish the means of overthrowing them by showing how absurd and inconsistent with the truth are their statements." Now, this is from a work called Against Heresies. So how is Irenaeus defining heresy here? These are all, he's cataloging heretics. So what does it mean to be a heretic here?
A belief system that's outside of his...
Right, a belief system where you've somehow distorted the original belief system to which a good Christian should subscribe. In other words, if you're a good Christian, you should have always believed in X, because that's the original truth. And somewhere along the way, people like Ptolemaeus and Valentinus have twisted things around. What else is important to recall here? It may only become noticeable in contrast with the rabbinic materials, but what is Irenaeus's project? Just, in other words,
he's against their promulgating.
Right. He doesn't like them spreading things, but let's drill down on that a little more. It's not enough for Irenaeus to describe what he believes.
No, he's going to show you how to combat this.
Yeah, so he's going to, but in order to do that, what does he have to do? In other words, Irenaeus isn't going to say you should believe X, Y, and Z.
No, he's going to show you the inconsistency.
Yeah, he's going to say, by the way, it's not just that I want you to believe X, Y, and Z. I want you to know that there are people who believe A, B, C, and I'm going to show you why those things are wrong. So in order to do this, Irenaeus has to really go through all the beliefs of all of his enemies, describe what they are, show why they're wrong, and only then can Irenaeus sort of enjoy his Christianity in peace. Okay, so this is how heresy comes to be used. It transforms from this sort of value-neutral or even positive term. It was a good thing to be a heresist, and this transforms in later Christian thought into blasphemy. Right, okay. So, the reason that I've sort of done this little word study together is because I want to make the point that, and I think this is crucial, let's just check the time, to assume that rabbinic literature must have its own category called heresy, I think is now called into question. Why? Because, now it doesn't necessarily mean that it doesn't, we have to look at the evidence, but we shouldn't assume that just because Christians have heresy, so too rabbis must have heresies, because after all, even the heresy that the Christians had, they sort of innovatively altered. In other words, the word heresy wasn't a category. The word heresy, meaning people who believe incorrect things, didn't always exist as a category. Now the Christians are simply making use of it, just as the rabbis might have made use of it.
Yeah, if you don't have chalmers on Shabbos, then by definition, you're a tzeduki, and therefore you are...
I'm just have bad taste.
You're out. I mean, you had to show you were not among... or you were unacceptable to the rabbis. So the rabbis clearly believed that tzedukim were...
True.
So they didn't use the word heretic, were heretic.
Well, true. So, but we have to ask ourselves if heresy... Right, so I'm already going to show my hand. I think that there are unacceptable... There are categories of unacceptability according to the rabbis, but we have to ask ourselves what they were and how to define them. In other words, for the Christians, what does it mean to be out of bounds? What are the criteria for being out of bounds, put simply, and in broadest possible terms?
You had to believe in the Trinity.
Well, that would put you in bounds. What would put you out of bounds?
Not to believe.
Believing wrong things.
Yeah.
Believing wrong things.
My only question is, all these sources are so early in Christianity that it's hard for me to believe that they really had a concept of what was in bounds in the first century.
So the answer to that question, which we're going to see hopefully a little bit more in two or three classes, is that if you were to read only, let's say, Irenaeus, or only Epiphanius, another one of the great heresiologists, or Eusebius, right, one of the great church historians, you would have no idea of the extent to which not only other forms of Christianity existed, but to which they were popular and to which they reflected in the earliest Christian texts. So, in other words, part of why Irenaeus is doing this is precisely because there's so much variety going on now.
I mean, I think he's trying to create the other. He doesn't actually know what it is.
Precisely. So let's keep that in your back pocket. It's an exceedingly important point, and we're going to come back to that.
The most chaotic, because then you're trying to...
Right. So let's keep these thoughts in our back pocket, because they're crucially important. Okay. But let's just to restate it briefly. Irenaeus is not sort of exposing incorrect Christianity. He's almost creating incorrect. He's creating incorrect Christianity.
What about
okay.
Incorrect Judaism?
Ah, so that brings us right into source number three?
Because the split between those who went off to be Christians
mm-hmm.
and the Jewish group was not even their beliefs. It was really, what was it, the Council of Nicaea, where they did away with
the Council
with
of
Bris.
Nicaea, right. So,
I mean, which was in the...
Doing away with Bris was already in the Book of Acts, the Council of Jerusalem. But again, this is...
But all their beliefs in Jesus didn't throw them out of Judaism. I mean, it's...
Right, so this is a topic for another time. I'm hopefully, in a later class, I want to return to this, because I'm very unsatisfied with how I taught Paul about 2 years ago. But the argument I would make in response is that, in fact, our best evidence, really our only evidence from Paul, suggests that even Paul, right, the apostle to the Gentiles, Paul never advocated the abrogation of the law, which is how later Christians and the church fathers in particular interpreted him. In fact, if you just read Paul's writings, it's clear that Paul not only was Shomer Torah Mitzvos to the extent that he understood that himself, but he also believed that all Jews were bound by the law. He thought the Gentiles were not bound by the law, and in that respect, he wasn't very remarkable, even within the tradition of rabbinic literature. Paul, even during his lifetime, was severely misunderstood, and I think that if you kind of read Paul's writing, you get a sense that a lot of this misunderstanding was his fault. And history will judge Paul in that respect. But what's important to recall just as we move forward is that it's far from clear that it's far from clear at what point, and this is going to be the topic of our next class, Jews, whatever that may mean, kick out Christians, whatever that may mean, from Judaism, whatever that might mean. Right. Excellent. So we're going to talk about that next time. But here what I want to do is look about what does it mean to be outside of bounds of Judaism? Because there is such a thing, of course. So take a look at the sources in source number three. We're going to confine our investigation to only sources from the Tanaitic period. And the reason is because we will look next time at sources from past the Tanaitic period. But if we want to be as careful as we can, as rigorous as we can, in trying to figure out what the situation is in Judaism in as early a period as we can, we have to confine ourselves to those sources. So let's say that we're trying to examine late second, early third centuries, right? So as Christianity has had a little bit of time to breathe, as the temple has had l'da'avenu, unfortunately, several decades to lie fallow, so rabbinic literature begins to discuss the problem of minus and to discuss the person that we would know as min, a person who, I don't want to translate the term because I don't want to prejudge it, but who normally we would translate as a heretic. So what does it mean to be a min? What makes you guilty of minus? Right, which normally is translated as heresy. So take a look at source number one from the Mishnah and Sanhedrin. Lafichach nivra adam yachid va'olam shelo yomru haminim reshu yos harbe bashamayim. Man was created singular in the world, rather as an individual in the world before Chava. Why was man create? Why didn't God create Adam and Chava at the exact same moment? And the answer is because it was important to demonstrate, according to Chazal, that the minim are incorrect to say that there are multiple powers in heaven. So how that precisely refutes the view that there are multiple powers in heaven aside from God. What seems to be the problem with minim in this source? What is problematic about minim?
In this case, they're polytheists.
Right. In this case, they believe something wrong. right? They believe wrong things. So here we have something that sounds precisely like how Irenaeus would use the word heresy, right? There are people who believe things that are incorrect, and therefore, in fact, according to Chazal, the Torah goes out of its way to cast creation in a certain way, or God goes out of his way to create the world in a certain way, so as to exclude from the bounds of polite discourse in Jewish society a particular view, a particular belief. So, as far as Chazal are concerned, it's possible, and as far as we're concerned at this point, it is within the bounds of Minos to believe something incorrect. Okay, now take a look at the next source. The next source is from the Mishnah Megillah. So, and just
here, the term minim, and I say this with reference to what's coming next, the term minim would tend to mean non-Jews.
Why?
Because those were the ones who were the believers in many gods.
Well, not necessarily. Right. In other words, you can find references. You could find references in Jewish sources to multiple powers in heaven. Maybe not equal powers, but you could find references in the book of Chanoch, in the sort of a later part of the Enochic works, so the similitudes of Enoch, where there seems to be God, and then there's an extremely powerful being called the Son of Man. And this Son of Man brings judgment to the world and judges the wicked, things that are normally reserved for God. Now, in other words, I don't think that this is equivalent to believing in multiple gods, which is how I think some, or equivalent to believing in, let's say, a deified Jesus, which is how some scholars will cast the similitudes of Enoch, which is what this work is called. But you can imagine Shtei Rishuyos Bashamayim not necessarily meaning two gods in the sense of sort of, you know, Tweedledee and Tweedledod, but in the sense of, you know, multiple divinities being in heaven. So Chazal did not like the idea of there being multiple divine powers. So it is possible that this refers to non-Jews, but then non-Jews wouldn't just be Shtei Rishuyos, like, in other words, Roman pagans, they wouldn't be Shtei Rishuyos Bashamayim, they would be Eleph Alfei Rishuyos Bashamayim, right? There would be innumerable powers in heaven. So here, it's hard to drill down on whether this means Jews or non-Jews, but at least, it's an important question, but at least we can be comfortable here saying that so far, Minos equals what Irenaeus will call heresy. Okay, let's take a look at source number two, Mishnah Megillah. And here this is not what you're going to find in your printed text, but it's in all the good manuscripts. And here again, the manuscript has what almost certainly is a mistake. If a person makes his tefillin round, it's dangerous because he hasn't fulfilled the commandment with it. And if he puts it on his forehead or the palm of his hands, this is the way of Minos. If he overlaid it with gold or placed it on the sleeve of his cloak, this is the way of outsiders.
So who does Hachatzunim?
The outsiders? Again, we can speculate, but ultimately I'm not sure that we know, because the Mishnah doesn't tell us. So I don't want to speculate.
But with regard to both of these, it would only be Jews that would put on tefillin. Yeah. So it would be self-professed Jews. They may be deviant, but they are self-professed Jews.
Precisely.
So there would seem to exclude.
Precisely, others. Precisely. And now it's possible, because we have evidence for this from Josephus and from later sources, from much later sources, that there were non-Jews who, without converting to Judaism, imitated Jewish practices and adopted certain Jewish legal practices, keeping the Sabbath, for example. So it's possible that this refers to non-Jews who were putting on tefillin, but you're right, the likelihood is that...
They'd be professed Jews even if they were not accepted Jews.
Right, I mean, they needn't necessarily identify as Jews. The category that we give these people, based on Josephus and some inscriptions that we have, would be God-fearers, Theosabeus.
Who are the group that converted? Herod is from the group that converted.
The Edomians. Right, presumably these are bona fide Jewish converts. According to Chazal, the later sources in Chazal, they were illegitimate converts, but it's not clear that that, let's say in the time of Josephus, that he thought they were illegitimate. Josephus hates Herod, and he never accuses him of being a false convert.
The author doesn't kind of assume as two different denominations, like the lesser incorrect and then the more incorrect.
Well, let's think here. In other words, what's the problem with Minos here? Let's do this definition. What does it mean to do something derech Minos? What are Chazal objecting to here?
Not definite to belief system, but definite to a practice.
So Mr. Common, I think, is absolutely correct. The problem here, it might be a belief, in other words, but there might be a deviant belief that underlies Chazal's issue here, the Mishnah's issue here, but the Mishnah doesn't cast it that way. The Mishnah is objecting to a particular halachic practice, which is to say, you're wearing your tefillin in a certain spot in your body, right? So if you wear your tefillin on your forehead or in the palm of your hand, you're a min, or at least you're doing things that minim do. So minim here is not thought of as heresy in the sense that Irenaeus is using it, as somebody who believes something deviant, but as somebody who has improper halachic practice. And so here, the category of minus, I think, is expanding a little bit beyond what heresy means, but it's also contracting. Which is to say, the expansion comes in the sense that being a min doesn't just mean believing something incorrect, it also means doing something incorrect, irrespective of your beliefs. But at the same time, minus is contracting because, after all, as our discussions here have borne out, whereas Irenaeus is concerned with the particulars of each and every heresy, and he tells you he's going to catalog them. He says, I'm going to tell you about Ptolemaeus's heresy, I'm going to tell you about Valentinus's heresy, I'm going to tell you about the Nazarenes, I'm going to tell you about the Epiphanius will later say, I'm going to tell you about the Ebionites. Chazal, or the Mishnah at least, our two Mishnayos so far, don't necessarily seem to be describing the same group of people in the first source and the second source. We have no evidence as of yet that there would have been a denomination known as the Minim, or at least that their opponents would have called the Minim, right? You couldn't walk into a shul, you couldn't compile Hilchos Minos.
He doesn't call it, if you do a lot of things wrong, because I would call you an Amaretz, because you didn't know
right.
how to do it.
Or as we saw last semester, three particular things wrong,
right.
Yeah.
But this is not, they're not being called Amaretz, because they're not doing it by mistake,
they're doing it on purpose.
They're defying the rabbi.
But do we necessarily know from these sources that a person who believes, in other words, is there any reason to assume that a person who believes that there are shtei reshuyos b'shamayim, there are two powers in heaven, is going to therefore wear his tefillin in the wrong way? Are those things logically connected? Or do we know that they're connected? Not necessarily. And in fact, as we pointed out earlier, it's possible that the first group of people are non-Jews, the second group of people are Jews. They're not even necessarily the same ethnicity, religion, whatever we're going to call it. So Chazal, even as they are expanding their definition of unacceptability, they're also contracting it in the sense that Chazal don't really care what makes a person, in other words, they don't really care what Minim think and what Minim believe, and they're not concerned to go into great detail about all the problems of Minas. What they are concerned is with what you should be doing if you want to do things the right way. It's what Chazal are concerned with. It's a very minimal.
How would you say that? Because in the first source, they are concerned with what you believe.
Well, that's true, but they don't. In other words, they're not concerned to describe precisely the belief system of people who believe in multiple reshuyos b'shamayim, which is why we have such a problem identifying them. Chazal aren't concerned to list all the things that these minim believe. They just say, if you want to do things the right way, so believe in one reshuyos b'shamayim, right? And read the chumash the way we're telling you to read the chumash.
I understand this whole comment. What are you getting at? What's the point that you want us to come away with from this?
Well, let's build our case a little bit further. Because right now, what I want to know is, what does it mean to be out of bounds for the Tanaim? What does it mean to be out of bounds for the Tanaim? And secondarily, how do the early members of Chazal conceive of those outside of their groups? Are they very concerned with what they think or not? Right? Those are very important questions to ask, because when we talk about heresy, especially in the Christian context, it's clear that, first of all, to be outside of the group means you believe wrong things, and number two, it's clear that we care very deeply about what you think, and we're going to spend all of our time and write entire books critiquing what you think. And those are very important things to know. Were Chazal interested in that? Were Chazal interested in being heretic hunters? And at the same time, were Chazal only concerned with wrong beliefs, or not concerned with wrong beliefs at all? So far, evidence suggests that none of these things are true. First of all, Chazal are concerned with correct beliefs, number one. But number two, Chazal are not particularly concerned to sit around all day discovering all of the minutia or critiquing all of the minutia of what deviant people believe. And number two, it's not even clear that Chazal saw multiple categories of deviant people. Chazal weren't concerned with defining what it means to be a Sadducee, because Chazal never defined that, what it means to be a Sadducee, what it means to be an Essene, what it means to be a person from Qumran, what it means to be a Zealot, what it means to be a Min. Chazal aren't concerned with the varieties and the minutiae of people who are not members of Chazal. They are concerned with defining what Chazal believe. So let's take a look at the next source.
They were acceptable deviances with Chabad.
We're going to get... So hold that thought for just a second. We're going to get to that in just a moment. Finally, the Tosefta tells us, and we're going to look at this source in great detail next time, Shemona Esrei Brachos She'amru Chachamim Keneged Shemona Esrei Askaros She'bahavu La'Hashem B'nei Elim. There are 18 Brachos in Shemona Esrei, for whatever reason, kol shel minim b'shel paroshin, b'shel geirim b'shel zakenim, b'shel David b'vonei Yerushalayim. Im amar eil latzman ve'il latzman yatzah. So the Septa tells us that there is a particular bracha in Shemona Esrei that is called the Birkas Haminim, which is a curse or a benediction against minim, and that bracha is included in the bracha, which is presumably thematically similar, against the paroshin, those who separate from the community. So what's the problem with minim here? Why are Chazal objecting to minim? It's because of something they believe?
Because they're separate.
Maybe. Yeah, precisely. In other words, it's not. It could be because of something they believe. It could be because of something they do that's wrong. But it doesn't. But whatever the reason is, the way that Chazal are expressing, or the way that the Tosefta rather is expressing its opposition to minim, is in social categories. In other words, if you separate from the community, if you're a parish, if you're a min, so the problem is that you are separating yourself from the community. So Chazal here are saying that the problem is not necessarily, or at least primarily, with what you believe, that could be the root cause of their separation. We don't care, presumably in this source, what you believe, what you do, even though in the other two sources, Chazal care deeply about those things. The problem here is that you're separating. So again, in this case, do we necessarily... Who are Minim? Are they Jews, non-Jews?
It doesn't define what the basis for the separation is. Is the separation ideological? Is the separation practical?
Right.
To say it's a matter of social choice.
Right, but presumably if you're not Jewish, I would imagine that separation is sort of a given. So presumably these are Jews, no?
If a guy stumbled over Baal HaShanim, you take him off the thing, because that showed he was here. So obviously they were worried about people who were pretending they were in, but in fact were out.
But we have to ask, where does that source appear? The Mishnah doesn't have that, right? So we're going to have to get to that.
Are they really concerned with the individual, or the fact that the individual is splitting the community?
Right, so in source number one and source number two, I think they're concerned with the individual. An individual with incorrect beliefs and an individual with incorrect halachic practice. In source number two, it sounds like they're more concerned with groups of people splitting off, or maybe with individuals, but in other words, their concern is group cohesiveness. Okay, so...
Could I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
This may be a bit of a tangent. There's 18 brachos, one of them of the 19, right? So,
according to the Bavli.
Right, so...
But not according to the Tosefta.
Oh, so that's the distinction.
Yeah, the Tosefta thinks that there are 18 brachos, and the reason that Birkas Aminim is included with the bracha against the paroshin is because we have to preserve the integrity of the number 18. The Bavli thinks that they added a separate bracha. We're going to have to go through all these sources and figure out what they all mean next time. Just in the interest of time, it looks like we're really out of time, so we're going to save the sources in source number 4 for next time. But they speak to Mr. Blank's point. The conclusion I want to draw from this, and it's going to lead us into next time, is the following. Our understanding of what it means to be deviant, according to Chazal, is both, I think, rather expansive and rather limited. First of all, I think what we can dispense with Meirosh is the notion that Chazal's concept of minus maps on directly to the Christian notion of heresy. They don't map onto each other for a variety of reasons. First of all, the Christian notion of heresy is not sort of drawing on an expansive notion of heresy that always existed. The Christians had to invent their notion of heresy, number one. Number two, whereas heresy for Irenaeus means incorrect belief, and belief that not only is incorrect, but is a distortion of an originally correct belief, for Chazal, minus is far more expansive than that. Minus doesn't just mean believing incorrect things. It also means doing incorrect things, holding incorrect halachic opinions, and simply being socially divisive. These are all improper things for Chazal. And yet, Chazal's understanding of what it means to be a heretic is also constricted, in the sense that Chazal are not spending their time at all defining what it means to be a min. They're not sitting around worrying all day long about what it is that the minim think. And it's not even clear from our evidence, and I think our discussion bears this out, that Chazal had a coherent, cohesive concept of what it meant to be a min. It's not clear to me from this evidence that Chazal thought that there are minim and all minim believe the same things, and that the min that Chazal are polemicizing against in these sources is the same min. For Chazal, the word min, as far as we can tell based on our evidence, seems to be used to mean anybody, whoever they may be, who is beyond the pale of what our community deems acceptable, whether that be in terms of belief, whether that be in terms of practice, whether it be in terms of divisiveness. Now, as we I had hoped to see tonight, but as we're going to see next time, Chazal are actually in other areas of their thought, and from texts that I think we can safely, if not uncontroversially, date to this time period, actually quite tolerant of diversity. So we have to ask ourselves...
There was not a coherent theology as opposed to Christianity, which was only concerned with trying to get the theology exactly correct.
Right, so we have to ask ourselves, so what does it mean to... In other words, what... It's clear that Chazal have a theology because they know what counts as being outside the bounds of that theology. But the question of... but again, theology, I think the word theology is already sort of giving the game away to people like Irenaeus, right? Because theology means, what do you think about God, right? Chazal's category is more expansive than that. They're worried about how you understand the halachic process. They're worried about creating divisions in the community, whether or not this has anything to do with halacha and belief. And so what I want to leave you with is that, although next time we're going to see that Chazal... Do have a great tolerance, and perhaps an unprecedented tolerance within the context of Judaism, or maybe properly precedented understanding of what it means to tolerate diversity, that I think in many respects is in continuity with some of the plurality that we've seen amongst early Judaism. So Chazal are quite tolerant of diversity. We're going to see next time. Yet, at the same time, two things are true. Number one, Chazal's tolerance is not limitless. And in fact, whereas I think there are those in our community who claim that Chazal have no limits to their theology or to their definition of minus, certainly seems to not be the case. Chazal also, so in other words, we should be clear that Chazal certainly think you have to believe certain things, they certainly think you have to do certain things, and they certainly think you have to behave in a certain way, whether or not that's demanded by halacha. Baseline.
How does Netanyahu get into this text?
Wow.
Look at the second last line on the bottom of the...
Rabibi, very good. Rabibi, very good. But what I'll leave you with before I dismiss you all is Chazal do not spend all of their time obsessing about the beliefs of those with whom they disagree. I think this is also a Musar Haskel for us at this particular juncture in time. While there are limits to what we tolerate and limits to what we believe, and we should enforce them and be proud of them and devote energy and thought to thinking about them, I think the contrapositive, or rather the converse, is certainly not true. I'll leave you with that. Yashikach, everybody.